The following is for your ears only. This week, celebrating our 31st anniversary on air, I'm David Halpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Boston's 9/11, murder and mayhem at the marathon on Patriots Day lead to a massive manhunt and roots going back to violent Muslim Chechnya.
Politics, guns, and governors. Fallout from the Boston bombing, the failure of gun control, and a new focus on states and their leaders.
Prospects for papal reform. Sooner than most expected, the new pontiff's words and actions suggest there may be greater changes in the wind.
Violence in Venezuela, the narrowest of presidential victories, and charges of voting irregularity lead to a recount and likely problems post-Chavez.
Anti-Earth Day, an environmentalist sees more marketing and commercialism than real help for the planet.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of April 21st, Earth Day, and our 31st anniversary on air, I'm David Halpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
Even with the smell of a smoke in the air, and blood on the streets, tears in our eyes, we triumphed over that hateful act on Monday afternoon.
We will find you, we will hold you accountable, but more than that, our fidelity to our way of life, to our free and open society, will only grow stronger.
We got that call, and we got the guy.
For all the words of comfort and support after the deadly bombing of last week's Boston Marathon, from Mayor Thomas Menino to President Barack Obama and a variety of other officials and clergy, the ones that most heartened the lockdown city and its environs likely came from Police Chief Edward DeVoe of nearby Watertown. After a shootout ended the life of one suspect and a sharp-eyed resident tipped law enforcement to the presence of the second, his seriously wounded younger brother, another round of gunfire and negotiation ended a terrorist nightmare unprecedented in American history.
But major questions remained. First, of course, what caused two immigrants with roots in Russia's violent-prone Muslim Chechen region, but years of education and apparent integration in the Boston area, to plant pressure cooker bombs loaded with shrapnel that killed three and injured nearly 200, many with severed limbs and worse, then come out of hiding to ambush an MIT security guard, confess to a motorist whose car they hijacked, and engage in a massive shootout that led to the beginning of their fiendish plot's end?
Also, what outside assistance or inspiration did they have? And did U.S. authorities fail to follow through years earlier on a warning from Russia about one brother who had visited there and was, in fact, interviewed by the FBI? To consider these and related issues for your ears only, we're joined again by Brian Bender, Boston Globe national security reporter in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Nice to be here.
For all the warnings against jumping to ethnic conclusions, it seems that Islam and international travel were involved. How surprised were your national security sources?
You know, and a lot of national security officials, counterterrorism officials, have been warning for years of this sort of homegrown phenomenon that, you know, the more likely attack won't be from a Al-Qaeda cell that's inserted into the United States, like was the case on 9/11, but youths growing up here, either born here or who had come here as immigrants, who may be indoctrinated overseas or on the internet by perhaps a charismatic imam or preacher. And, you know, I think in this case, it's sort of a combination of the two, it sounds like. The older brother in particular traveled back to Russia. It's not clear where he was. He was there for at least 6 months in 2012, sources have been saying. And, you know, his father was living there, so he probably visited dad, but who knows what else he did. Could he have trained? And that's one of the things that I think the autopsy, if you will, that's being done on the bombs might be able to tell authorities, which is, did they have training? These are fairly rudimentary weapons that they used, but apparently I'm told they were made quite well. In other words, they either really did their homework or they had someone who may have been helping them.
Did the endgame suggest a failure of escape route planning by Jakar and his 26-year-old brother Tamerlan after their surprisingly successful attack? Or was it, in fact, an extension of that attack, tossing more bombs from the car they hijacked, one of them wearing a suicide vest, and his eventual suicide by cop?
Well, you know, it's hard to say, but clearly they didn't have an escape plan, or at least a very effective one, in the immediate aftermath of Monday's marathon bombings, because they would have gotten out of Boston or gotten on a plane. So my gut tells me that once footsteps were coming, if you will, on Wednesday, they had been identified as suspects. Obviously, those images went out across the world. They were going to go out with a bang, and I think that's probably where they killed the police officer, as you said, were armed with additional weapons, additional explosives, and figured they would go on a rampage. At least that's what it seems like.
Do your sources think there probably are others in the U.S. who knowingly supported the brothers' marathon plot, maybe failed them in some way at the end?
You know, that's another big question that I think is unanswered and that the investigators are really trying to get to the bottom of, and that is, were there other people involved in the plot here in the United States or overseas? We saw reports last night that three individuals were taken into custody, I think, in New Bedford, Massachusetts. But that may be just simply people who might have known them, gone to school with them, perhaps roommates of theirs. So it may just simply be to learn more about their whereabouts and their activities in recent days. But, you know, I think, obviously, it's an unanswered question. Were there other people that were aware of it who didn't alert the authorities? You know, one thing that popped up yesterday, one of the uncles of these brothers who I interviewed had made a reference to the older brother, the older nephew of his, calling him on Wednesday and telling him that basically he was sorry for what he had done to the family. And what struck me about that was, like, did that uncle then alert the authorities? Because clearly his nephew was, sounded like, acknowledging that he had been responsible for Monday's attack. So it's not just simply looking for people who might have known about the plot ahead of time, but people who, you know, in the 2 or 3 days after the attack, who might have known something. You know, did everybody come forward or did they not? So, it's still pretty early in this investigation, my sense is.
Speaking of the older brother, do you expect political controversy over the fact that the FBI did interview Tamerlan at the Russians' request but did not follow up with monitoring that might have detected increasing radicalization?
Well, there's no doubt that that's going to be a source of controversy. I think it's very likely that congressional committees that oversee intelligence, Homeland Security, are going to want to know what exactly happened. There could possibly be hearings because, I mean, clearly this kid was doing something that the Russians thought didn't seem right. And you know, we don't know a whole lot about what the FBI did, how they followed up or how they didn't. But, you know, but clearly he was a problem child, at least in the view of some. And obviously, if the FBI didn't interview him, they didn't pick up on something that led them to follow him, to track him more, because obviously he was able to pull this off.
Some say the virtual lockdown of Boston and environs was a bad precedent, even if there were questions about more bombs and accomplices in the area. What's your view?
Yeah, I've heard that. I mean, I guess my sense is that this was done out of abundance of caution, as authorities are scrambling to find out the scope of this plot, not just tracking down the fugitive yesterday, but could there be others on the loose? But, you know, they didn't declare martial law. You weren't required to stay in your house. I mean, a lot of my colleagues at the Boston Globe were running all over Boston yesterday, and nobody stopped them. So I don't read too much into that. I mean, obviously, if martial law had been declared and you were told you have to stay in your house, and then, you know, civil liberties questions arise from that, then I could see there being a legitimate gripe. But nobody had to stay home. You could do whatever the heck you wanted.
Brian Bender, Boston Globe national security reporter in Washington.
Quote from the news, a truly nightmare scenario. That was Texas Governor Rick Perry after an explosion with the force of a 2.1 magnitude earthquake in a fertilizer plant demolished much of the small town of West. Blast killed at least 15 and injured nearly 100 people, with many others still missing.
Next, political fallout from the bombing, gun control, and more for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Collaborative effort. That was Kaufman County, Texas Sheriff David Burns on the arrest of former Justice of the Peace Eric Williams and his wife for the murders of two prosecutors and one of their wives in revenge for Williams' earlier conviction for office theft. Initial speculation centered on the Aryan Nation of Texas prison gang. Now this.
The yeas are 54. The nays are 46. Under the previous order requiring 60 votes for the adoption of this amendment, the amendment is not agreed to.
So all in all, this was a pretty shameful day for Washington. But this effort is not over. I want to make it clear to the American people, we can still bring about meaningful changes that reduce gun violence so long as the American people don't give up on it.
Vice President Joe Biden looked grim last week announcing the vote, and President Obama sounded furious at the failure of even watered-down gun control, despite support by a bipartisan Senate majority. But it was not clear how another big push, even more distant from the Newtown School massacre that mobilized widespread hope for change, might succeed. The horror of the Boston Marathon bombings seemed only to underscore the argument of gun rights advocates that weapons controls don't prevent violent crime. And the fact that the suspects were immigrants from a troubled Muslim region of Russia may well provide new ammunition for Republican opponents of immigration reform, despite the issue's importance to Hispanic voters crucial to the party's future.
The failure of the FBI to follow up on an interview it did years ago with one of the bombing suspects on a request from Russia after his visit there may also heighten doubts about the federal government generally. A new Pew poll last week showed only 28% with a favorable opinion of the federal bureaucracy versus 57% for their state government. That raised the prospects for several current governors with possible White House ambitions. To discuss all those political developments, we're joined once more by Julian Zelizer, Princeton professor of history and public affairs, author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think the immigrant status of the Boston bombers will have a significant impact on immigration reform?
It could. Some members of Congress have already raised the issue. They've tried to make the connection to raise doubts about the bill. And obviously the big question was already House Republicans, who have a very strong anti-immigrant faction there, or anti-immigration faction. And I'm sure some will play on this issue to raise doubts about whether the immigration measure is safe for national security.
Do you expect a political issue to arise over the FBI interview with one Boston bombing suspect and no follow-up that might have prevented the nightmare?
I think it will, as we see with all of these national security crises and even shootings in schools. After this happens, after we finally resolve the crisis itself, there's a look into what we missed and why it could have been stopped and why it wasn't. And in this case, there was this FBI interview, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of scrutiny to why this was allowed to, just go away.
On gun control, conventional wisdom says it was never likely to pass. Do you think even more activism and millions of dollars in media and political contributions by Mayor Bloomberg and others can defeat congressmen who are loyal to their conservative districts and to the NRA on this issue?
It's extremely hard. I think what Bloomberg's group can do and what money for gun regulations can do is really get people in districts that are not very strong in favor of gun rights, get them more mobilized, get them more active, get them to put more pressure on legislators who otherwise would just remain quiet and rather this issue go away. I think that's where they can have their biggest effect. In the very, very red districts, it's going to be hard for someone like Mayor Bloomberg to really shift public opinion.
Is there more hope for campaign spending to change minds or votes on gun control in the Senate, where members have to run statewide?
Yes. I mean, that's really your best bet. That's how we saw some potential progress on immigration. The Senate is the area these days where there's more room for flexibility. A senator has to win the whole state. A legislator just has to win their particular district. So inevitably, they're dealing with a more diverse constituency. But ultimately, gun rights has to get through the House as well. And so I think proponents of regulation need to figure out a way around this.
One reason that conservative congressmen are so entrenched is the way congressional districts are drawn to protect their incumbency by state legislatures. Should the Democratic Party be putting more resources into state-level politics to regain majorities that can redraw those lines?
Absolutely. I mean, there's two areas Democrats have not done that much in the era of Obama. One is in trying to reform the political process, campaign finance issues, which are important on the gun rights issue. And second is really having a bigger impact on the states. Ultimately, that's where the power is. We see that, how districts are drawn, how much gerrymandering is going on. Unless Democrats can change the dynamics, the House Republicans are going to remain exactly where they are, and they're not going to get those votes.
Let's talk about some state leaders now drawing presidential speculation and what you call a dangerous Dukakis effect that governors can face when they try for the White House. First of all, how many governors have become president, especially in recent times?
Since FDR, we've had five, so that's a good number from FDR through George W. Bush. They, in recent years, have been really a dominant force in presidential politics. Voters tend to look at someone who's been an executive in politics, and governor is more appealing now than Senate, senator, or representative. Senators have lost some of their ability, although we have Obama, to win over the governor. So they've become quite important since FDR, for sure.
What liabilities do you mean by the Dukakis effect? How did they impact the presidential campaign of former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis?
All that means is that what a governor runs on is the state. They run on their record in the state. They use their record on the state to show what they can do as chief executive of the entire nation. But, you know, the record of the state can also bring them down. It can be used against them. Michael Dukakis ran on the Massachusetts miracle. He ran on the claim that he revitalized the economy. And George H.W. Bush used Massachusetts against him. He talked about pollution in the water. He talked about signs of an economic downturn. He used the famous Willie Horton ad, which was about a furlough program in Massachusetts. And he used the state to drag down the candidacy. And so all the governors thinking of running have to keep that in mind.
How do you see the Dukakis effect applying to New York's Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo?
Well, he's one of the, you know, most exciting prospects in the minds of many people. And right now there's a huge corruption story coming out of the state, all centered around this kind of corrupt effort to buy a place on the mayoral ticket. And that story will probably expand, and that's one example of something Cuomo will have to contend with. A lot of the structural problems of New York, that's just the economic problems, and if this story of corruption unfolds, how close it gets to him. It's sure to be an issue if he runs, because a Republican would use this to talk about the kind of Washington he would bring with him.
And New Jersey's Republican Governor Chris Christie?
Well, he's interesting. I mean, he's used his state effectively. He's used the idea that a Republican can govern in Democratic territory effectively. He, too, though, has faced some challenges. Most recently, this scandal over Rutgers University and the coach who was yelling and throwing things at the players. And some people say he wasn't really very forceful in dealing with the university, even though he talked tough against the coach. That's just one of the kinds of issues that comes out of the state. He, too, will have stories of corruption. He'll have stories of government spending, which will anger a lot of Republicans. So he's going to have to face this challenge as well.
Julian Zelizer is a Princeton professor of history and public affairs and author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America.
Quote from the news, I wouldn't say the crisis is past, but maybe we're in a less dangerous phase. That was Evans J.R. Revere, a former State Department expert on Asia, as North Korea took a more moderate tone after weeks of escalating missile and nuclear threats.
Next, signs of change at the Vatican, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. Like a lost, pathetic child. That was from a forthcoming memoir by Amanda Knox on her confusing, ambiguous behavior during her trial on charges of murdering a fellow exchange student in Italy. Her conviction was later reversed on appeal, but reinstated by the Italian Supreme Court. Now this.
Will the Pope lead a reform? Absolutely. Does the Church need reform? Always. That's because the Church is made up of you and me, who are sinners. We're imperfect. We fail. And so the kind of reform that will be led by Pope Francis, like the one led by St. Francis of Assisi, his patron, will be a reform that calls all of us to look deep within our own souls, within our hearts, and to see if we really and truly are following Christ with the authenticity and integrity that should mark the life of every Christian.
Just a day after Buffalo Bishop Richard Malone posted that prediction, the Vatican announced that Pope Francis had created a new permanent panel of cardinals around the world to advise on reforming the powerful but much criticized Vatican bureaucracy, the Curia. It was perhaps the most dramatic step so far by the new pontiff to suggest changes in the wind from his papacy, though balanced by an announcement that he had reaffirmed the recent critique and proposed restraints on socially activist and liberal U.S. nuns, the Leadership Council of Women Religious.
On a more day-to-day note, it was reported last week that the new pope continues his memorably modest lifestyle, phoning a cobbler back home in Buenos Aires to arrange for repair of the simple black shoes he brought with him from there. To consider various Vatican signs of changes to come, we're joined again by Professor Patrick Hornbeck, Associate Chair of the Fordham University Theology Department. Welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Let's start with the case against the Curia. What are the major complaints?
I think the best way to think about this is a phrase that Pope Francis himself has been using from very early on in his pontificate. And he says that the church should avoid what he calls self-referentiality. I think that's a churchy way of saying navel-gazing. And I think what the Pope means by that is that when the church spends its time thinking about itself, when it spends its time getting wrapped up in its various rules and regulations and so on and so forth, it loses sight of what the Pope takes to be the church's primary mission, the mission of the church, to preach the gospel to the world and to go and do service among those who are most needy. And so I think people, even more broadly, Catholic people here in the U.S. and around the world, look at a curia that's mostly male, that's mostly clerical, and they think that it's out of touch. They think that it's out of date. They think that what's happening in the Curia doesn't reflect the real lives and situations of Catholic people around the globe.
And what do we know about how at least some of the cardinals named to this new advisory panel feel about what reforms of the Curia are needed?
Well, I'm not sure we know specifically about any of these cardinals. They've not made direct statements since they've been named to the group. But I think it's worth pausing a moment just to think about what this advisory panel is. Both in the secular world and in the church world, I think we're used to thinking about, you know, blue ribbon commissions that are set up to resolve a particular problem. And this isn't that. This isn't the Pope commissioning a committee report that will come back. In the announcement of the group being set up, what the Vatican said was that this was a permanent council of advisors. So I think we might say that for the first time either ever, or certainly for the first time in a very long while, the Pope now has a cabinet, just like the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Great Britain has a cabinet. And these are folk who are going to be working very closely with him, these eight cardinals, as he moves forward with the reforms of the Curia.
The only U.S. cardinal named to this new panel has a reputation for dealing with sexually abusive priests.
That's right. That's Cardinal Sean O'Malley of the Archdiocese of Boston. He's a Franciscan friar, so just like the Pope himself, not coming out of the diocesan world, but rather coming out of a religious community. And Cardinal O'Malley was actually one of those folks who was being discussed as a possible pope. He was very well regarded in Boston for the way in which he handled the sexual abuse crisis. And I think that as a Franciscan, as someone who deliberately and intentionally follows the simplicity and the humility of Francis of Assisi, he's a great choice for a panel like this.
Ironically, while the Bishop of Buffalo seemed to be reassuring members of the Curia that they were not being sidestepped, there were also assurances last week that the Pope was not weakening his own power. What would lead to that fear?
Well, the papacy is one of the last absolute monarchies on the face of the planet. It's a very small absolute monarchy. The Vatican City-State has about 650 citizens. But more broadly speaking, in terms of the Church, Catholic teaching still holds that the Pope has fullness of power over the Church all over the world. And I think that there's some concern among some parts of the Church that setting up a cabinet, setting up an advisory group, might put the Pope under someone else's jurisdiction or might compel the Pope to do something. And I don't think that's what's happening at all. I think Francis, in keeping with the style that he brought with him from Buenos Aires, I think what Pope Francis is doing is assembling a group of people whom he trusts to give him advice. And it seems that his past track record is to solicit that advice and then to make his own decision.
The Pope also said it would be foolish to ignore the power of the Holy Spirit behind the Second Vatican Council and the reforms that it spawned so many years ago. Talk about that.
Sure. The Second Vatican Council was a major church meeting from 1962 to 1965. For most U.S. Catholics, the most memorable thing that it did is it permitted the Mass to be said in English rather than Latin. But there's a lot more to the Council than that. And in particular, the Council called for what it described as greater collegiality between the Pope and between all the bishops around the world. And I think that there are some who didn't agree with that finding. I think there are some who, in the time since the council, would prefer for the council not to have happened or have wanted to roll back those reforms. And I think that what Pope Francis is saying is that the work of Vatican II is unfinished. It seems like a long time. We're celebrating its 50th anniversary, you know, these last few years. But in the world of a church that's existed for two millennia, that's not all that much time. And there's certainly a lot more time to see what the legacy of that council will be.
Somewhat in line with what the Bishop of Buffalo had to say, the Pope last week urged responding to God's will with the heart as well as the mind to avoid ideological views that distort the gospel and weigh down the church. What ideologies specifically do you think he had in mind?
I think what we've seen from this Pope so far is that there's a deep distrust of any ideology that distracts from the mission of the church, to preach the gospel, to serve the poor. And so it's difficult to use our U.S. political labels in these contexts. But I think he's saying that a liberal ideology and a conservative ideology that are so wrapped up in themselves that they can't look outside themselves and can't look past particular political convictions to see what God is doing in the church or what Christ is doing in the church, those are things that the Pope has no interest in. And I think what's interesting is that I hope as time goes on, we'll see that that applies both to what we might think of as the right and what we might think of as the left, although those labels don't really work well in the church world.
Professor Patrick Hornbeck is associate chair of the Fordham University Theology Department.
Quote from the news, "It's the perfect ending for such a debacle." That was paralegal Michael Redman on a first batch of settlement checks to victims of mortgage impropriety that could not be cashed because of insufficient funds. Officials said the glitch would be quickly fixed.
Next, voting and violence in Venezuela, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. People just panic and the stress hormone kicks in. That was Avanidar Subramanyam, a UCLA professor of behavioral finance, on the dramatic $290 billion plunge in Apple stock prices because of initial overexuberance and maturing of the PC and laptop market. Also last week, the Blackstone Investment Group walked away from its bid for sinking Dell computers, but Microsoft reported that software sales had produced a 19% rise in profits. Now this.
Este reclamo es pacífico.
This claim is peaceful. And if someone departs from this peaceful theme, he is not with me. Even more, he is doing damage to me.
Even with the second look at presidential voting in Venezuela demanded by opposition candidate Enrique Capriles after widespread and violent protests that claimed at least seven lives, Nicolas Maduro last week was sworn in as the handpicked successor to the country's late left-wing leader Hugo Chavez. But his razor-thin victory, just 1.5% of the vote, was seen by many as the worst possible outcome for Maduro and his country, leaving questions about his legitimacy and his ability to unite divided Chavez loyalists, not to mention continuing opposition by Capriles and his near majority of followers.
Venezuela has both the world's largest proven oil reserves and a deteriorating economy. And it challenges U.S. policy in the region, with Washington initially withholding support of Maduro, while most neighboring nations and many others worldwide were represented at his swearing-in. To consider the prospects for Venezuela after the voting and the violence, for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Christopher Garman, Director for Latin America at Eurasia Group, International Risk Consultant. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
There were initial doubts that the government of incumbent Maduro would give in to Capriles' demands for a recount. What led to the compromise of an expanded audit, and how did it differ from a full recount?
Well, the administration at first was hesitating to conduct a full recount, but ultimately they opted for a partial backtrack in engaging an audit because social tensions were getting too acute. The population emerged highly polarized after the election results, and the government was facing the prospect of sustained protests from supporters of Capriles. And we were heading to a potentially very dangerous social and political environment to the extent that the administration had begun to threaten to imprison the leadership of the opposition. So I think what happened was, faced with the prospect of of a real risk of short-term political institutional instability, the government backed down and partially gave in to these demands. They did not accept a recount, but they accepted to continue to audit many of the polling stations. The National Electoral Commission already had audited 54% of the polling stations, and so what the government did was to promise to audit the rest. It doesn't necessarily entail a recount, but in theory you are double-checking whether the manual count matches up with the electronic voting. So you're not doing it fully, but it is meeting halfway to the demands from the opposition.
Some say Capriles has already won in a way by establishing his own political base and demonstrating the relative weakness of Maduro, whose vote total was 10 percentage points less than Chavez himself won less than a year ago. So what tactics do you expect from Capriles and the opposition going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that initial appraisal. You can make the case that Capriles is in a comfortable position right now, because if he were to have won the election and assumed office, he would have had to assume office in a context where you have Chavista forces controlling the judiciary, the military, and also in an environment where he would have to make difficult macroeconomic adjustments. Let's remember that the Venezuelan economy is in dire straits. You have close to 50% of the products that are whose prices are controlled. You have a state-owned oil company, PDVSA, which has been spending irresponsibly. Debt levels are rising. And what we really need in Venezuela is some difficult decisions which are not politically popular. So now, after almost having won and established himself as the clear leader of the opposition, what Capriles' strategy will probably be is try to utilize whatever opportunities he has over the next 6 months up to 2 years to continue to put pressure on the administration, protest when certain measures that are unpopular are taken, and put himself in a position to run for the presidency again. And there's a decent chance that Maduro may not finish his term, because if his administration indeed has to make some difficult adjustments, or if he doesn't make difficult adjustments, the Venezuelan economy is also going to face rampant inflation, food and good scarcity. In other words, odds are that Maduro is going to continue to lose popular support over the next 6 to 12 months.
What are the major issues dividing Venezuela under Maduro and the United States?
You know, the larger issue is, you know, we're coming on a relatively long period, you know, led by Hugo Chavez, who has projected an anti-U.S. Foreign policy stance. The relationship is an interesting one because it's one in which the government is bellicose in its rhetoric, but Venezuela still depends upon trade with the United States, either to export oil or even import products. To a certain extent, of course, Venezuela has looked to strengthen strategic partnerships with China on the one hand and Iran on the other, to a concern of the administration. And I think that the larger concern of the administration is has been, at least over the past 5 to 6 years, the potential for Chavez to destabilize and spread his style of politics in the region. That risk really has diminished in a material way because Venezuela is headed to a cycle of economic difficulty and crisis, and its capacity to fund allies in the region is really diminished.
To what degree does U.S. reluctance to recognize Maduro undermine Washington's credibility and influence with regional nations that do, including Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Bolivia, and Argentina?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to impact the U.S.'s credibility in the region all that much. You know, despite the fact that the U.S. has not recognized the election result just yet, the broader foreign policy objective will be just to wait by the sidelines and not do much. And to be honest, that's probably the most prudent foreign policy stance that the administration could take.
Christopher Garman is Director for Latin America and Emerging Markets at Eurasia Group, International Risk Consultants.
Quote from the news, waste of money, rest in shame. Those were protesters along the funeral route of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, largely overpowered by the clapping of supporters chanting, Maggie, Maggie, Maggie.
Next, an anti-Earth Day message for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. We haven't found Earth 2.0 yet, but we can taste it, smell it right there on our technological fingertips. That was University of California, Berkeley astronomer Jeffrey Marcy on the discovery of two planets with the size and temperature that could support life. Now this.
Please give me a clear blue ocean where laughing dolphins play. Let me have a deep green forest where sleepy bears yawn at end of day.
Annie Dinerman's Earth and Sky, sung by Nancy Lamott, represents the simple, not to say simplistic, spirit of Earth Day that comes around again this week. But laughing dolphins and sleepy bears aside, how seriously do Americans really take the future of the environment, especially the companies already deep into their annual Earth Day green PR spin? And how can they all benefit by getting to the heart of the issue?
Sustainability guru Eric Lowitt has some answers, managing director of the Nexus Global Advisors. He's a globally recognized expert in the field of competitive strategies and has authored a number of successful books, including The Future of Value, that helps organizations grow by integrating their sustainability and competitive strategies, and The Collaboration Economy, due out next month from Josie Bass. And for your ears only, we're pleased to have author, speaker, and consultant Eric Lowitt on the line with us now. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
First, give us your definition of the term sustainable and green, especially as used on products of all sorts, and explain why those two terms may not be interchangeable.
And many times people actually try to interchange these two terms. So simply put, when we think of green, we think of Mother Earth, right? We think of the song that we just heard. We think of the environment. From a company perspective, that translates into reduced waste, reduced water consumption, reduced energy. From a product perspective that you and all of our listeners can touch and feel, it means solar panels, putting solar panels on our roofs to reduce the amount of energy that we take from the energy grid. And there is goodness there. Sustainability encompasses green, but it goes beyond green. Sustainability is also about social development and economic development. As a product example, think Ben and Jerry's, Chubby Hubby ice cream. Right? It's produced from an environmental conscious perspective, a green perspective, in that the farmers use energy consumption and waste and water consumption efforts to reduce all those levels. But it's also produced from a social development perspective, in that Ben and Jerry's pays the farmers from whom they source all of their ingredients wages that are far above regular competitive market rates. And as a result, you and I buy what's a delicious ice cream and feel good about it. So there's an economic piece. So sustainability encompasses green. Green is solely focused on the environment.
I like that flavor, too. But with Earth Day again this week, you recently posted an article on your blog entitled Why I Dislike Earth Day. What led you to write the piece, and what are the main reasons?
So I think Earth Day is one of these types of holidays. It's on everybody's calendar, happens once a year. It's happened for 43 years. And people, I fear, have fallen into this trap of believing, hey, you know what, as long as we turn our lights off for 12 hours or we take the waste out of our garage and recycle it properly one day in a year, we can check that to-do list box off of our annual to-do list. We've done our part for greening the world. We can go on and buy more ice cream on a day-to-day basis. And while I think that's okay, I felt, you know, after 43 years, Earth Day started in April 1970, after 43 years of one day a year focused not on sustainability but solely on the narrow lens of green, it's time for us to stand up and say, gosh, you know what? We have climate change impacts that we're feeling far broader and far faster than the most draconian scientists told us we would. Just witness the Midwest drought last year, witness Superstorm Sandy, various blizzards up here in the Northeast as well. So I felt that there was this need to take a step back and give people a chance to look at our Earth Day activities and say, you know, is it enough to be, quote-unquote, green one day and think that just being green one day is going to make our planet sustainable for 364 days.
Well, tell us what you mean by the not very flattering term greenwashing.
Gosh, yeah. So there are a number of companies out there that, you know, driven by marketing, they like to sell sizzle and not necessarily their steak. What that means from a greenwash perspective is that there are companies out there that'll say, hey, we're 100% green. You got to buy from us, right? And that's all fine and good until you realize you know what? If I think about it, you're a company that's selling water that you pulled from Fiji, flew it across the world to get it into my store, and somehow I'm supposed to buy that because you tell me it's good for the planet, as opposed to buying locally sourced water or just turning the faucet on. So greenwashing is companies' efforts to sell their green initiatives that not only don't do what they say they do, but beyond that, the green efforts and the green messages that they're selling don't even properly reflect the green activities at the company level.
Besides Ben and Jerry's, what are some of the companies or organizations with the best overall record on sustainability and real environmental consciousness?
So think Coca-Cola, for example. Coca-Cola, 5 years ago, saw water as kind of an ancillary, non-core business activity. Today, if you talk with their CEO, Muhtar Kent, he'll tell you that water is so central to the company's strategy and company's survivability. Because in the end, very simple logic, no water, no product, no Coca-Cola company. They're clearly focused on improving water, not only improving access to water, not only for themselves, but for the local communities in which they operate.
Eric Lowitt is a management consultant, speaker, and author of the forthcoming book, The Collaboration Economy, How to Meet Business, Social, and Environmental Needs and Gain Competitive Advantage from Josie Boss Publishers. His essay on Earth Day appears at ericlowitt.com.
One wish for you and me and every butterfly. All I want for Christmas is the earth and sky.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and the Stitcher.com app for mobile devices. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugat at the Hanger Studio Played Productions with intern Sarah Skirman. I'm Eddie Robinson.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities and award-winning ACAM Associates, Exceptional Management, Impeccable Reputation, for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern. Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago. This week, as on past anniversaries, we dig back to our debut 31 years ago as Newsweek on Air. From that first April 25, 1982 broadcast, co-hosted by Gil Gross of the RKO Radio Networks, and its 25th anniversary encore on April 22, 2007, hosted by Catherine Herzog and me.
The presses are rolling at Newsweek, and we'll be talking to the reporters, the columnists, and the newsmakers who are featured in Newsweek this week.
I'm Newsweek senior editor Dave Alpern.
And I'm RKO correspondent Gil Gross. Welcome.
Our very first story was on a crisis still confounding us.
No more war, no more bloodshed, no more bereavement. Peace unto you, shalom, salam forever.
When Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and the late Egyptian President Anwar Sadat reached a peace agreement with U.S. President Jimmy Carter at Camp David, it began a new era of relationships in the Middle East. But with Israel's formal return of the Sinai Desert to Egypt this weekend, that era is ending, and there are very serious questions about what will happen next.
We have Newsweek diplomatic correspondent John Walcott on the line with us from Washington. John, with the Sinai going back to Egypt now, what do you see as the biggest roadblock to a Middle East peace?
Well, obviously, Gil, the biggest roadblock is the Palestinian problem. And I think it's important to recognize that the Palestinian problem and the invasion of Lebanon that you and Mike were just chatting about are very closely related. Since Camp David, the United States, Israel, and Egypt have been trying to negotiate some form of self-government for the over a million Arabs who live on the West Bank and in Gaza. They've gotten nowhere. The United States has never really pushed that idea hard. And as a result, Prime Minister Begin and Defense Minister Sharon have really been free to pursue their own policy on the West Bank, which amounts to extending a form of second-class citizenship to to the Arabs who live there. The problem with doing that is the PLO. The PLO resists. The PLO is armed. It has an ability to kill Israeli soldiers and Jewish settlers. It's controlled from Lebanon. So ultimately, if you're going to pacify the West Bank in the fashion that Begin seems to want to, you have to destroy the PLO where it lives, which means you have to go into Lebanon.
Israel did occupy Lebanon for years, but ultimately had to withdraw. The Palestinian problem remains.
The First Newsweek on Air also considered a looming war between Argentina and Britain over the Falkland Islands and a familiar battle over the federal budget.
For more than a month now, the White House and congressional leaders have been trying to work out a compromise on President Reagan's proposed budget for the coming fiscal year. For a while last week, it seemed that they might come up with something, but time and again, the announcement was postponed, and in the end, it seemed that a detailed deal would be put off until at least this coming week, maybe indefinitely. David, seems to be a kind of a spectator sport to many Americans. There's a lot riding on a resolution of this budget fandango, the state of the nation's economy, interest rates, money available for social programs, and the size of the bite each of us has taken from the IRS.
That's true. And to shed some light on the problems preventing a budget settlement, we've got the White House correspondent Eleanor Clift on the line now and congressional correspondent Gloria Borger. Eleanor, at the beginning of the week, it seemed that the White House was beginning to show a little more willingness to tamper with President Reagan's original budget proposal. What prompted that flourish of flexibility?
Well, I think that flexibility has been present for a couple of weeks, if not months, as Ronald Reagan sees the economy deteriorating around him. And I believe there is broad agreement on the part of those that are negotiating, Democrats, Republicans, on what needs to be done. The problem is politics. I think the Democrats are about to conclude there's more in it for them come the November congressional elections if they don't bail Ronald Reagan out on the economy. And I think we may see a stalemate.
Gloria Borger, politics aside, is there a personality problem between these two most important figures in the budget debate, the president and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill?
Well, Tip O'Neill is always the first to tell you that Ronald Reagan is a fine fella and that after 6 o'clock at night they get together and get along very well. I think the problem here is that they have some very, very basic differences on their attitude towards government.
There were lighter topics, too, on that first show. Atlanta's winning baseball Braves, Knoxville's World's Fair, and black comic Richard Pryor.
Because I was watching TV, man. I was all bandaged up, and they said I was going to die. They said, Richard Pryor died 5 minutes ago. Ooh, no!
Richard Pryor set himself ablaze one day while freebasing, making a potent batch of cocaine. He says that that brush with death has changed him, but he also says he still hears the coke demon lurking nearby, saying, that's okay, Rich. I'll take care of you. This is a man who shot up his car, said a girlfriend's mink stole on fire, went to jail on a tax charge, has had fist fights with his co-stars, been through 4 marriages, and has used language on TV and on stage that would make a sailor's parrot blush. But he is also just about the hottest performer around. Richard Pryor is our Newsweek cover story this week, and Los Angeles correspondent David Friendly is with us to talk about him. David, tell us something about the background of Richard Pryor. Where does he come from that would help explain where he gets his sense of humor?
His roots are as unlikely, I think, as his success today. He's from Peoria, Illinois, and he goes back to that often. He grew up not as a poor, struggling black man as one might think from his comedy, but in a fairly middle-class upbringing. And I think his success is just so surprising to so many people today, and they view him as a real overnight success when, in fact, he's been in this business for more than 2 decades now.
We tried adding a little humor of our own.
We would have played more Richard Pryor, but the FCC still licenses a lot of radio stations.
It's called Pryor Restraint.
Joining us now is the original co-host of Newsweek on Air, Gil Gross, currently an anchor with ABC Radio News in Los Angeles. Gil, what do you remember most about that first show in the early years of Newsweek on Air?
You know, what I remember about it is the two of us being given this assignment and just sort of sitting over coffee in the Newsweek building inventing this thing. I have since worked on programs for large networks with tons of consultants that have expired after 3 months. I'm just thinking how funny it is the two of us came up with this thing that lasted 25 years.
First words from our April 25th, 1982 Newsweek on Air debut and a 25th anniversary encore on April 22nd, 2007. Clearly, some of the same problems of politics and foreign policy persist. As some of you may recall, financial problems at what was formerly Newsweek magazine 2 years ago forced us to go independent and nonprofit as For Your Ears Only. Gil Gross now hosts a weekday talk show on KKSF Radio in Oakland, San Francisco. John Walcott is team leader for national security and foreign affairs at Bloomberg News. Gloria Borger is chief political analyst at CNN. And David Friendly is a Hollywood film producer best known for Little Miss Sunshine. Eleanor Clift, a national TV commentator and contributor to Newsweek DailyBeast.com, still appears regularly on this program. With thanks to all the stations and listeners who have joined us for any part of the last 31 years, I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Mary Claire Herron with what we like to think of as an anthem for our show.
This moment, this minute, and each second in it will leave a glow upon the sky. And as time goes by, it will never die. This will be my shining hour, calm and happy and bright. And in my dreams, your face will flower through the darkness of the night, like the of home before me, or an angel watching o'er me. This will be my shining hour till I'm with you again.